Welcome to Extreme Genes, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And you have found us. It's America's family history show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And I'm so glad to have you along today. We got some great interviews. First, starting out with Heath Jones later in the show. Now, he's with a group called Task Force History. And we've had him on before. They're based in Heflin, Alabama. And they go around and actually research different places, Civil War battlefield sites, and they gather materials. And sometimes they find things that relate to specific families and try to track down descendants who might be interested in owning those items just as a service. And Heath is going to be joined by one of his buddies who's actually had that experience recently. And you won't believe some of the stuff that he's uncovered. It's going to be a great interview coming up in about 8 minutes. And then later in the show, we're going to talk to a Jersey City librarian who has written a fabulous digitizing article in NJ.com, NewJersey.com, talking about some of the challenges for smaller organizations like local libraries when they go to digitize and how you might be able to help as a volunteer. We'll talk to Danny Klein later in the show. But right now, let's check in with my good friend, the chief genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org, David Allen Lambert. How are you, sir?
I'm not too bad out here in Beantown. It's a nice sunny day. Looking forward to some summer weather very shortly.
Yes, I got to tell you, the strange thing has come up. Recently, the father of a dear friend of mine passed away, and a bunch of neighbors got together and said, look, we're going to get flowers, but we'd like to get her something else. And one of the things that this person proposed was that we get a piece of jewelry with a fingerprint of the deceased on the jewelry.
Oh.
And my wife and I...
Was this done before they died?
No. No, they wanted to see if they couldn't actually get to see the mortician to get the fingerprint of the deceased and then pass this on to the people who would create the jewelry from the corpse.
Oh, that's intriguing. Well, I can say that I've looked at a lot of funeral home records. That's a line item that I've never seen before.
Well, I went online and found that there are such things there, but I'm just a little creeped out by it myself and wanted to get your take on it. What do you think? Would you want that?
Well, you know, I might just have to put that in my as a codicil to my will, you know, for my kids to have a Christmas ornament made out of all my fingerprints so I can touch upon every Christmas, no pun intended.
And on the back, by the way, you can have the photograph of the deceased. Now, I don't know if that's that different from a lock of hair or something that they've done historically in the past, but I'm just picturing the mortician grabbing the thumb of the deceased and dipping it in ink, and then I'm bothered by this.
Going through eternity with a dirty thumb.
Well, let's get on with our family histoire news for today. What do you have, my friend?
Well, in technological advances, MyHeritage, one of our sponsors, has released a new thing called a sun chart. The sun chart was created to solve a particular problem in genealogy. It's, when you do a regular chart, you're limited to the space. This chart is to plot out as many descendants as possible on a smallest chart as possible. And the chart will have hundreds or even thousands of people on it and can be prepared in a circular format. If you go to MyHeritage, you will see an example of it. And if you're not a MyHeritage user, you can import your GEDCOM and generate this chart.
Now, we're talking not just descendants. You can do it for ancestors as well, right?
Absolutely. It works in both ways.
And it's great because you can have photographs on all these things, so it can be a huge photo chart. And I've seen it. It looks really attractive.
Yeah, my good friend Daniel Horowitz, who's the chief genealogist and officer there, sent an example of the chart, and it looks quite impressive. It makes me want to get all my cousins to send photographs so I can actually do one for my grandmother's 100th anniversary of all of her descendants from her first marriage. So that might give a holiday present, but hopefully I won't be sending any fingerprints of the dead. By the way, happy belated Flag Day. But here's a little piece of trivia for all of our genies out there. Most of them will probably remember that Betsy Ross designed our nation's first flag. But the real question is, do you know who designed the current flag?
The 50-star flag.
Correct. Most people will have to stop and think, and they'll probably think it's some government agency. But it's not the case. It was actually a kid. It was a 17-year-old boy, the late Robert Heft, who died sadly at the age of 68 in 2009. He had a high school project to design it, and the teacher originally gave him a B- and discussed the grade with him after school. And the teacher said, well, if Congress adopts your flag, I'll reconsider the grade. And lo and behold, Congress adopted his flag and the kid got an A.
Well, so, I'm sure it was more meaningful to him that Congress adopted the flag than what the grade was.
I think so. And Bob will go down in history as also having ideas to design from the 51st to the 60-star flag. So he probably has patents for his descendants that are lying in wait in case we add Puerto Rico or get even bigger.
Right.
So fabulous little historical trivia for you. One of the things that I always like to toss out is that NEHDS, besides our free database, we do Vita Brevis, which is our blog. And my good friend and colleague, Lindsay Fulton, the director of our research service, wrote one today called Something Old, Something New. And it talks about the day of the wedding when you get something borrowed, something old, something new, something blue. And it made me think, what a wonderful tech tip this is. What did you have at your wedding? Can you recall? I'm going to have to stop and ask my wife what she used. And do we have it written down?
That's a good point. I don't remember those things. You're right.
Then, you know, if our listeners have their parents or grandparents or great aunts and uncles, why not ask them? It's that filling in that dash in our life between the dates on that stone. This is one avenue that may not be in your wedding album. So it's something kind of cool to consider.
All right.
Every week, NEHDS has a free guest user database, and this week is no exception. We have the Western Massachusetts families in the 1790 census, continued added sketches to that. Well, that's about all I have from this week from Beantown. Catch you next week with some more exciting family history news.
All right. Thanks so much, David. Always good chatting with you. And coming up next, we're going to talk to the man who put together a group called Task Force History in Heflin, Alabama. Heath Jones joins us talking about some of his group's latest discoveries, and he'll introduce us to a friend who made an interesting discovery of his own. That's next on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. I'm thinking it was somewhere around 2 years ago when I first learned about my next guest, Heath Jones, with Task Force History based in Heflin, Alabama. And Heath is one of those people that loves to go out and investigate things buried under the dirt, especially when they relate to the Civil War. And Task Force History has been kind of growing and getting a lot of publicity over the last couple of years, but it's been like a year since we've had him on. Heath, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Fisher. It's good to be back, as always.
Fill me in on what you guys have found recently and how that might tie into some families.
Well, you know, we've been out looking at, we always do, trying to find something new. Some of our recent finds, not necessarily families, but we've narrowed a couple finds down to like one of the last two ironclad ships, the Confederacy, which, you know, people may have family members that were on those crews. I recently found part of a shell that we know came from one of two Confederate gunships, ironclad gunships, the CSS Huntsville or the CSS Tuscaloosa.
Wow.
Now, while we can't tie that to an actual family, we can find out who the sailors were that were on those ships, and chances are one of those sailors fired one of those guns that we found the projectile to, or part of the projectile to.
Isn't that amazing? Where was this area?
That was down in South Alabama near the coast, near the Mobile coast.
Now, you guys go out, what, on a regular basis, every weekend, every month? How often, and how do you do it?
Well, you know, Scott, we use metal detectors for what we do. That's pretty much the consensus of everything we do. And then we research spots. We don't have a set time. We research spots till we have enough information on it. And then we go about the spot and search it, grid search it, and try to find items. And sometimes we find items that actually relate to individual soldiers and tell a story.
Right. And in fact, you've got one of your colleagues on the other line right now in Paducah, Kentucky. Justin Emmons is there. Justin, welcome to Extreme Genes.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, I was looking at your story here, Justin, that you wrote about and your experience here recently doing the same kind of thing that Heath does. Tell us about this adventure you recently went on.
Well, my dad and I, as Heath has pointed out, we metal detect. So we do the same things that Heath and his guys do. So we research sites either with, you know, firsthand journals or letters written back and forth from the officers. And out here in western Kentucky and western Tennessee, where my dad mostly hunt, it's really early war sites.
Okay.
So we find a lot of artifacts that kind of link towards the soldiers using kind of older weapons, older gear, because, you know, when the war started and ramped up out here in the West, they still had those older weapons. So we find a lot of, you know, artifacts that most people kind of are hard pressed to find, like a 69 caliber bullets. But my dad and I stumbled upon this specific site mostly because of one of my undergrad friends who knew that I metal detected, and she actually told me that supposedly there was a Civil War fort or camp, you know, around her house. So me and my dad went out there probably about 5 years ago, and we started finding, you know, just mostly bullets. We found a Union breastplate, but we hadn't really been back, you know, for probably about 1 or 2 years until my dad and I went back in February of this year. And we extended out our search from the main camp and started to search a gently sloping hill on the backside of the property.
So was this where they were all spread out? You think maybe they were camped individually, just going further and further from the center of the camp?
Yes and no. So we knew that this site must have been a camp or a picket because it was guarding one of the entrances into the small town.
Ah.
So we knew that they had at least a small camp there just to watch the road for any Confederates coming from one way at least.
Okay.
It's kind of on this nice little gently sloping hill. So we expanded the search to go, you know, further out. And that's when we started finding knapsack hooks and knapsack pieces that look like they were either thrown off the hill or had been moved by dirt work, pushing dirt off the hill. But in this small area of where I found some knapsack parts, I found a little small printing press letter block.
Wow.
And it's probably 1 centimeter by 3 centimeters, and it's a rectangular object. And these would have been used to stack the letters, you know, to make words and then sentences and then, you know, articles to print, you know, newspapers and just, you know, papers to hand out.
Sure.
So I found this and didn't really give it much thought.
Why would a soldier have something like that?
See, that's the mystery, because normally a soldier, a private, you know, the regular fighting man, wouldn't really have access to a printing press block. So that's kind of a mystery on how this guy actually got the printing press block.
Right.
But as I went home and cleaned it up, I noticed that there was some sort of carving on it. And right then, I got really excited because when you see something carved, either a bullet carved or something carved, you know that that's very personal. So I started cleaning it off and noticed that there was a name carved on two sides of the block.
And the name was?
Well, on one side, it had the letter H and then Garlock, G-A-R-L-O-C-K.
Okay.
It was all in cursive. And then on the other side, it had just Garlock, but in lowercase.
Okay, that's kind of a confirmation there.
Yes, it was. So I used the National Park Service on their website, their Civil War Soldiers Database.
Yes.
It was very useful, and started searching up soldiers' names with the first letter of the first name started with H and Garlock. And I stumbled upon this soldier's name, Henry Garlock, who was a private in the 21st Missouri Infantry, Company B. And using research through the internet, I figured out that that specific unit had been camped in that town during 1862 to 63.
How cool is that? Oh, that must have been thrilling.
Yeah, so I kind of got a, you know, clarification that, yes, Henry Garlock, that was his personal piece. And it is a mystery on why he had the printing press block and that possibly could have been in that knapsack, because I found tons of little, you know, odds and ends around that, you know, knapsack part area.
Hmm.
So the mystery is that could have been Henry's knapsack. It either broke or he lost it, and he lost his little personal, you know, named piece.
Well, maybe there was somebody in his family that was tied to the newspaper business. It was a little trinket.
Yeah, it could be that, yeah. So you just never know, because Dad did more research on him and the unit, and before they had gone up to the small little town, they were down in Vicksburg and in Tupelo, Mississippi, in Arkansas. So they had been, you know, down there. So he could have picked it up in one of the bigger towns down there. found it, you know, just laying on the side of a road. You never know.
Thought it was interesting, yeah. So tell me, have you made any attempt to locate descendants of this guy?
I have, and I've run into some problems.
Okay.
So I, at the time, had a subscription to Ancestry.com because I was looking at my own family history, and I was also using Family Search, which, you know, is the free one.
Yep.
And I was also using Find a Grave. And through all three of those, I found that Henry's middle name was Cuppet, and I figured out, you know, where he was born, his birth year, and his family. And through specifically Find a Grave, they had a lot of information on him and his descendants. And I got to about his great-great-grandson, which was still alive about 6 to 7 years ago. And that is kind of where it fizzled out.
Oh?
Because most of his descendants, there's only one family line with the name Garlock still.
Okay.
The other ones either have women who married off. So there's only one line of Garlocks left. And I'm having trouble finding their descendants right now.
With the name line. Now, Heath, you've had a couple of experiences. We talked on the show a year or two ago about how you and one of your colleagues actually returned a family piece to a woman who was living on the property of her ancestors from like 150 years ago. This is kind of a really fun thing to do, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's just part of what we do and really a rewarding part of what we do, Fisher, to be able to return something like that and to watch somebody's face light up that, you know, this is, you know, in some cases, not as far removed, but it's still really cool to see that.
Well, Justin, maybe we can help you see if we can't find somebody who descends from Henry Cuppet Garlock.
Oh, yeah, I would love that because we're really good at, you know, finding the sites, finding the relics, but I'm not that experienced in, you know, ancestry and that. So I would love if we could find either a direct descendant Garlock or a direct descendant from him that may have gone down a female line.
Yeah, that'd be exciting, wouldn't it? And to see their expression, to know that you've got something that belonged to their great-great-great-grandpappy in the Civil War. Unbelievable mm-hmm. stuff.
Scott, if I can interject, we're always looking for members that have experience in genealogy as well as metal detecting. If you have any members that are interested in both, we're always looking for new members of Task Force History.
Awesome. Where do they go?
They can go to our Facebook page, Task Force History. Search that on Facebook and you'll find us.
Well, it's always fun to check in with you guys and Task Force History and see what's going on in Alabama and, in this case, Paducah, Kentucky as well. Justin, thanks for coming on. Heath, as always, great to catch up with you and see what you're up to.
Hey, we enjoyed it. Thanks for having us on, Fisher.
Thank you, buddy. Take care. And coming up for you, we're going to talk to Danny Klein, a New Jersey librarian, about what it takes to get into digitization at the local level and how you might be able to help on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And the changes we have seen in family history research and the documents that are available online right now, especially over the last 10 years, incredible. And I think we start taking it for granted that so many pages are being added to all the major sites every day, Family Search, MyHeritage, Ancestry. But there are a lot of other places that are digitizing things as well, smaller places, and it's a little bit more of an issue for them to get a lot of stuff done. And I greatly enjoyed a recent article written by my next guest. His name is Danny Klein. He's a librarian at the Jersey City Public Library in Hudson County, New Jersey. And Danny, welcome to Extreme Genes. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You guys are constantly digitizing, even at your level, every day, and there's a lot to this, isn't there?
There is. It's a long and can be very tedious and intricate process in digitizing documents.
Now, what kind of documents do you get at the Jersey City Public Library?
Well, we do a lot of images for our photo collection, but we are looking into starting to do some of the documents from our manuscript and other collections.
Okay, and so you have...
Like our city directories.
Your city directories, which are very important, of course, especially filling in gaps during certain census years.
Absolutely.
Take us through the process of how this works.
Well, you know, you put a city directory, which some of the ones that we have, going back to 1849, are very fragile. So you have to be very careful in scanning them. And then there's a process of taking that scanned image, which is basically a picture of words. There's no way to gather the information off of it other than looking at it, and then turning that into searchable text.
Right, and that's quite a process in and of itself. It's one thing to make the image and get it scanned. It's another thing to actually make it usable, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, the software that actually does that is certainly not perfect, and it can take quite a bit of editing and looking at things to try and get them into the proper shape.
Do you actually have to go through a directory, which can be 100 or 200 pages, I would assume, and look for errors in terms of how the software has interpreted each character?
Well, you know, we go through it as best we can, and then that text has to be turned into something that can be searched. And then looking through it, we, like I said, we try and go through it the best we can.
Right. But if you find an error, is there actually a way to correct it?
Well, it's basically a text file, which is part of the metadata.
Right. And let's talk about that. You did a great job of explaining metadata in your article in NJ.com. Talk about what that means and why it's important.
Well, metadata, the standard description that goes along with metadata is that it's data about the data. So if you take, for instance, the music that might be on your phone, then as you do a search for that, the metadata for the song, which would be the data, then you're looking for the data about the data, which would be the song title or the time or who the composer was, or even the album art that gets displayed while you're listening to it. That is the metadata, and all that is stored into a database.
Right.
So bringing that to a genealogical document like a city directory, the person's name or their address might be separate metadata fields which would accompany the picture of the page, which can then be searched. Those fields can then be searched, and that helps to display the document that you're looking for.
And certainly makes it a lot more usable. Although certainly we see times like on Family Search, there are a lot of things that have been scanned and are available online, but they haven't put the metadata in there yet. You can still go through it and look, but it's a lot harder, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, those kind of browsable databases where they're browsable but not searchable, by posting them, you're actually doing, it's a little bit of a service in that you're posting them and people can look at them, but the information you're looking for isn't readily findable in that document.
Yeah, it's a lot harder to do unless you already have an idea of the era or the place or something like that that can lead you to the right page in there. They do that, for instance, with a lot of probate records from around the country, because there's so many of them, they just want to get them up first, and in time, they'll be able to add that metadata to make them much more searchable. So in your role at the public library in Jersey City, do you actually use volunteers to help you with this process?
Right now, we're not. We are currently testing out a digital asset management software that will enable us to eventually put all our things online. But right now, we're just kind of in the testing stage.
Talk about those fragile documents a little bit more. I've got to imagine that's got to be a very delicate operation with some.
Absolutely. Fragile documents need definite TLC because just by touching them in the wrong way or manhandling them, it can do a lot of damage to these documents. So, you know, taking photographs is definitely a way around that.
Yeah, and that kind of brings us to the question about books, Danny, because obviously you've got a binding in there, and often they're photographed badly, either in a scanner or just with a picture taken of them, because of the fact they kind of curve into the binding. How do you deal with those? Obviously, you don't want to damage the books, but they're also not very usable if people can't get to see them, right?
Right. Well, you know, you have to be very careful with books as well. Because of the binding, you can't open them up too much. So you may have to create some kind of a stand where you're able to place the book and then do a flat, so the page is flat and then more easily photographed. Some books are difficult because of the way that they're bound. Sometimes the text seems to go right into the crevice of the binding. So that makes it a little bit more difficult, and a stand by photographing it can actually help display the book correctly so you can take a good photograph of it.
Fascinating. Well, you know, it's great to know that this is all being done at local levels, and I would assume this is kind of going on within libraries everywhere right now. We tend to think mostly about, you know, the big companies, but you guys are doing important work, too. Is this common throughout the state of New Jersey and in the East and throughout the country? Are you aware?
No, it's not really common because of the trying to get volunteers and then the complexity and just the workflow that's involved. It can be very long and tedious work to get some of this work done.
Well, there's such a hunger for it, and we're sure appreciative of organizations like yours, Danny, that's getting this work up there, because once it's done, it's there forever for all of us to take advantage of. So thank you so much for your time. Great article in NJ.com. He is Danny Klein. He's with the Jersey City Public Library in Hudson County, New Jersey. And thanks for the education on it. You know, I've never really thought much about the process because obviously the big boys kind of have it all down, but there are some small ones who are out there trying to do the same thing, and it's important work.
Well, thank you very much, Scott, and thank you for having me.
And by the way, the New Jersey room of the Jersey City Free Public Library has scanned 112 documents, maps, and images related to the Dutch settlement of what is now Jersey City. And those items have been included in the New Jersey Digital Highway and statewide digital initiative run from Rutgers University. And they're also testing a local digital library, which they hope to expand and make public in the future. So smaller organizations making a big impact. And coming up next for you, our Preservation Authority returns. Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He's going to be answering another listener question about preserving audio this time on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. My name is Fisher. I'm your radio root sleuth. He's Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He's our Preservation Authority. Say hi, Tom, so they know you're here.
Hi, Tom.
Okay, very nice. And Tom, we got another email. This is from Mary Lee Call. She wrote to you at AskTom@TMCPlace.com about a cache of 30 mini cassette tapes she's got, all from her dad. She says she'd like to use Audacity to digitize the tapes unless you have something else to suggest. So what are your thoughts, Tom?
You know, it depends exactly how deep you want to get into things. Just like I've explained on this show numerous times, what your end means. What do you want to do? If all you're trying to do is just get it digitized, not do any editing or very minor editing, Audacity is a great program. We've talked a lot about Pro Tools on this show. It's what you use yourself, Fish, and
yes,
most professionals use.
That's correct. Yeah, I've done it for years. Pro Tools is a great program.
It gives you so many more options. If you want to really get in there and clear things up, clean things up, you know, add more narration on top of it, you know, all different kinds of things, Pro Tools is definitely the way to go. And so what she's got, basically, she's got those old micro cassettes, and she wants to get them on her laptop, but doesn't know how to get them on her laptop. Thank heaven somebody in her family kept the old machine that they were recorded on, and it wasn't one of these little teeny ones. This is like a big desktop module.
Okay.
And the problem is, okay, she's got this problem. She's got all these cassettes. She wants to get them digitized so she can use them in Audacity or Pro Tools, but something in the middle is missing. And luckily, it's something really, really simple. In fact, we have people coming in the store right now to talk to us about this, which I'll get into in a minute. As long as you have a piece of equipment that has a headphone jack where you plug headphones into, whether it's the big headphones or the micro headphones, anytime there's an out on it, you can always find a way to get it into your computer. In her situation, all she needs is a cable that has a miniature stereo plug on one end, and then on the other end, depending on what your computer is, like if you have a PC that has a little RCA jacks, usually one's red and one's white.
Yes.
That's what she would need on the other end of her cable. Plug it in and just run the tapes and do it all in real time. Don't do it in high speed, you know, because a lot of people do high speed, then they go in and change the speed. Use good cables. In the old days, I'd tell you to go to Radio Shack, but Radio Shack basically is a cell phone store now.
Yeah.
You can go to bnhphoto.com. They have things. You can go on Amazon and find cables. You know, and if you have a question like she does, send me a picture of your equipment, both the machine that you have and your laptop or your desktop, whether it's a Mac or PC, and I can tell you exactly what kind of cable you need to look for, and then you can go and type that into Amazon or a Google search, and you'll be able to find the cables. Because you want to make sure you get the right kind of cables because you don't want to jury rig it so something's not going to sound good.
Well, sure. And you start changing the speeds, it really does cause some problems. And we've had that before, too, where I've actually worked on some audio and tried to compress it to get it from like a minute and 3 seconds if you're cutting a commercial and you want it down to 1 minute. And it leaps. It causes some leaps in the audio. So it's easier to actually edit breaths than it is to compress or change or alter the speed. And certainly that would be the case with these as well, especially if you did it at, you know, double time.
See, that's what people don't understand. They know, okay, this is my tape. I want it on a disc. No big deal. Well, you know, you're changing people from French to English. Basically, you've got this item which is analog. It just flows just like a waveform does, or you throw a rock into a pond and the waves go. That's how analog works. Where digital isn't. Digital is like, you know, if your kids play Minecraft, it's little squares. Mm-hmm. There's zeros and ones. There's ons and off. And so if you have a zero here and a one over here, what goes in between it? And if you're doing something high speed and the machine's going, hey, what am I supposed to do here? There's something missing. You're going to hear clicks and glitches and things like that. So you want to make sure you have good equipment. That's why you can go to some place like Costco and buy this piece of equipment for $200 and find out, why isn't it compatible with my stuff I send off to my nephew? You know, you got to be really careful with stuff like this. We have a lot of customers that come into our store that have tried going to the big box retailers and had problems with them saying they couldn't fix their stuff and their stuff was really okay. You got to realize when you go into the big box retailers, yeah, they make their own bread there. They make a lot of their own deli items there. But when you're dropping off tapes to have them transfer, they're not doing it. They're popping off to some place, sometimes in the States, sometimes overseas, and you don't know until you get your thing back, and sometimes it's stamped rejected. And we've had those come into us all the time, and they work fine. So you really need to be careful. If you want to stay local, find a local engineer that actually does this work on site that you can ask the questions. If you have questions with us, ask us, and we can maybe lead you to somebody.
Well, you think about it. I understand why people would go to a big box store. They have a brand name. They do things well. They do it inexpensively. And that's mostly how we operate, right? Well,
exactly.
Reputation, we don't necessarily realize there's a lot more to things like digitizing and preserving things than what a big box store can do. And a local person can do a much better job typically.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Take an 8-track into a big box store, hand it to the guy across the counter and say, can you transfer this? He probably doesn't even know what it is.
Right. Well, that's true.
Yeah. You go to a local guy, they're going to say, oh, I can't do this, or I can recommend this place. We have people coming to us that need repair jobs done that is beyond our scope, but we know somebody that we trust that we can send you to. Or if you're going across a counter and they have no idea what you even have there, there's no way they have the experience to send you to someplace that is able to take care of you. And like we talked about, a good source for finding things if you want to do your own transfers yourself is bnhphoto.com. Has a lot of good quality equipment that you can buy. There are good people to call and talk to. They'll find out what your needs are. But every time, which we mentioned in the first segment, find out what your final need is. And as we kind of mentioned in the first segment too about cables, you want to make sure you get the right kind of cables because that's important. You want to spend $5 on a cable that you're going to transfer all your old memories, or you can spend $10 and get one that's going to sound so much better.
So getting back to Mary Lee's original question then, Tom, what are your thoughts on a program for her in digitization?
You know, I love Audacity. If you're familiar with it and it works for you, rock and roll. If you're going to be learning a new program, I really recommend Pro Tools because it gives you so many more options, different things you can do. And one thing that's really interesting, we had just a few weeks ago on June 10th, we had our 43-year anniversary, and we had somebody come into the store that had a little cell phone, and they go, hey, this doesn't take SD cards. How can I get these phone conversations off of here? I want to record them. And sometimes it's so simple, it's right in front of you. All the new smartphones have an ear jack where you can listen to headphones or whatever. That's all you need. You can plug a cable into that, plug it into your audio card on your computer. In fact, if you're a Mac person, usually you have USBs. They make little cables you can get from Amazon that has a USB and a small jack on the other end, which is what plugs into your phone. Plug it in, put in the USB, and rock and roll. If you have an old PC tower, you can buy cards for like $25, an audio card. They're very inexpensive. They're really good. They have them at Best Buy. Get them at Amazon. Plug them in. You know, load them in Audacity, Pro Tools, however you want. And then one thing you always want to make sure you do, once you get it in there before you do your editing, make it into an MP3 and put it on the cloud.
All right. Always great advice, Tom. Thanks for coming, and we'll see you again next week.
Sounds good. We'll see you then.
Well, that wraps up our show for this week. Thanks once again to Heath Jones from Task Force History down in Heflin, Alabama, and his buddy Justin Emmons from Paducah, Kentucky, for coming on and talking about their recent metal detecting finds and how they're tying them back to descendants of Civil War soldiers. And to Danny Klein from the Jersey City Library, talking about the challenges of digitization and how you can be a part of it. Hey, if you missed any of it, catch the podcast. Talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. This has been Extreme Genes. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.